From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. That's Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, and Kaylin Brown, professor of communication at St. Rose, the college thereof.
Yes.
I got that a little bit backwards. The College of St. Rose. Now, I started to say St. Rose University, but that is not what it's called.
Not yet.
It should be.
And I am an associate professor, though the students just call me professor.
They just call you Professor Brown.
Well, they call the adjuncts professor, too.
Yes, yes, but there's a distinction, so
well, okay.
Putting that out
I
there.
I appreciate the clarification. We try to be precise in these things. Corrections being one of the best read parts of the newspaper, by the way. We put all of our corrections on page two, and people just love to read corrections. You
know? They do, and It's important that we use those. We do that in student journalism, and it matters.
Well, you know, I'm always amused that the New York Times does it, because they'll always say, we spelled her name Anne. It's really A-N-N-E, as
right.
If this is the kind of thing we have to worry about.
Well, it shows that a devotion to precision is part of the mindset, and so that's good, and you want to encourage that. The difficulty is, I remember a conversation at an editor's conference a dozen years ago about whether there should be any penalty for reporters who make a lot of mistakes, because you want reporters to report their mistakes to you. You want them to tell you when there's an error in the story so that you can correct it. But they surely realize that if they are inaccurate, you're going to say, yeah, why do we have this guy working here, you know?
Indeed, we do not want reporters to have files full of inaccuracies. But the New York Times did something funny and published a book called Kill Duck Before Serving, which is a book filled with many inaccuracies that have been published over the years, because evidently in a recipe they failed to include the fact that it would be a dead duck one would serve and not a live one. So it's really quite a funny little book of corrections.
And speaking of chit-chat, I want to say that Thanksgiving is here now, and I want to give thanks for both you, Kaylin,
okay,
and Rex.
Sarah. Okay, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, are you opening the door for that right now?
No.
Oh, in the press room yesterday, I believe it was.
As we are taping this show quite a bit in advance of the holiday,
yeah,
which
yeah,
will
of
be
course.
Long gone.
It will be, but still the press officer for the White House required that the reporters in the room please explain for what they were thankful prior to them asking a question.
Oh, my.
That's right.
And she led the way, and the New Yorker and the Washington Post have both had stories about the fact that she did this, and the New Yorker especially called to task the reporters for agreeing to do this, because each of them did to varying degrees. But
what did she say? What was her thing?
She was thankful for family and on, just the typical things each of us probably would be thankful for. But she was manipulating the reporting staff there.
Yeah, you know, I one of the things I would really fault Saturday Night Live for is the fact that they keep making her out to be a really fat lady. You know, they do that. They add pounds and make her seem extraordinarily fat. And I don't think that's fair, because I think she, in fact, you know, has lost a lot of weight, but it doesn't really matter in these days, because we don't notice these kinds
but
of
now,
things professionally.
Alan, come
what?
On. This is a pot calling a kettle black. You make fun of people's weight all the time. It's a laugh line around here.
Not at all. I mean, she's... not at all.
All right. Somebody's nose is growing into the microphone as we speak here.
Not at all. I think SNL is just really wrong for continually portraying her as being very fat.
I'm more interested in the fact she might be portrayed as a liar, because that we have factual evidence to back up. So
go.
I'd rather have them portray her for that.
It does. I think you're right. This does actually raise Alan's point here is humor can sometimes be problematic, I think. And this it raises a point about the coverage of the Al Franken groping
Absolutely.
Incident. The photograph that people associate with the Al Franken allegation shows him as a comedian initially.
Yes.
Was he pretending to, or was he actually, in fact?
No, I think he was pretending to. I don't know that there's real touching of the breasts, but maybe there was. You know, he's leaning over this this woman and doing this thing. And she said, I was asleep. I didn't even know that it was happening. But you're right, Rex, to make the distinction, this was done perhaps lewdly when he was a comedian, but not when he was a senator.
Not his best moment. The photograph is evidence that it was not his best moment. The incidences of sexual harassment and assault continue to grow. There have been some pretty interesting arguments about the reasons to keep Franken in office from the progressive side of the aisle.
I hear it all the time. I get one telephone call after another here, or I hear by email from my people on the sort of left who are saying, it's not the same thing. This guy's not the same thing. So, you know, does the press make that distinction, this being the Media Project?
It is a hard distinction to make, and I think it's worth noting that the similar question is coming at me. I mean, people all the time make me answer for all the sins of the media as though I'm the news director
as well, they should,
CBS News or something. But he's the question about a person last night said to me, why are you only reporting all these bad allegations? You know, it could be that these women are lying. Why are you only giving the side of the story of the women? And I felt there are several problems with that. A, we're not. We're letting Roy Moore, obviously, in coverage is given his opportunity. But it is as though when you make a decision to publish something about this, you're implicitly saying there's enough evidence here to support it that it is valid to report. You don't take just any allegation that somebody walks into a newsroom with. If somebody were to come in tomorrow and say, yeah, you can't publish my name because I'm a victim, but I have this person who is prominent here did bad things to me. You know, you don't automatically jump to that as a journalist. You do make an assessment.
So the key question then would be, Rex, and sorry for having to put you on the spot because you've set this whole thing up, but has that ever happened?
Yes.
Somebody's come in and said, okay, this guy was rude to me or whatever.
Or yes, we have. It is not unusual for us to have allegations that we are unable to substantiate or allegations that we believe to be true, but it takes us a long time before we can actually publish it. Actually, a case study is the recently elected Runcie County executive-elect, Steve McLaughlin, assembly member. We had for some time allegations that allegedly had an altercation with a staff member, that he had engaged in really bad behavior with them. It wasn't until we actually got a tape recording and saw a post on Twitter of staff member with a black eye linking to McLaughlin that we felt that we had enough to go with a story. Similarly, former Congressman John Sweeney, we had for almost a year, we had almost confirmed information about a police call to his home where his wife had said, according to the dispatch accounts we had, that he was throwing her around. They denied it. We couldn't publish anything until just a few days before the election when he was first running against Kirsten Gillibrand. We finally got the documentation that was in effect the fourth source. We had three human sources, and finally we had documents from the state police files that confirmed precisely what the human sources had told us, and I decided to go ahead with the story. But, you know, so you can't just go with an allegation, even if you have, like, that's why the two source rule is a little bit of an outmoded thing. You may have two sources, but that's not really enough, especially if you're going to claim that a United States congressman had police respond to his house in a domestic violence incident.
So let me get this two sources thing straight from both of you. You teach it, Rex, you do it. Of course, the question of who the sources are, right? How much credibility they have and what they have to say. It's not just two sources. It has to be what backup they have, right?
Yes, and the documentation to which Rex referred really matters as well. It's important to get documentation whenever possible. I was just attending an event where Rex was a panelist, actually, in which a New York Times reporter, Kim Barker, talked about the difficulty now in filing Freedom of Information requests, both at the federal level and the state level, and that government seems to be more resistant than ever to sharing information just with a phone call. It used to be we cultivated sources. You would ask, could we have access to this information? And there was a more ready revelation of the information. Agencies at the state would turn over information more readily. Now every ask practically feels like a request under the law. You have to ask for it under the law and then follow that through to its conclusion, which is easier for some and not for others, those who have corporations behind them and that sort of financial wherewithal to support litigation if necessary, if a freedom of information is denied. That is an expensive and lengthy endeavor, and our listeners would benefit from learning about and hearing about how reporters go about getting the information. Research takes a long time.
It does. A lot of stories wait months before being told because the government actively resists transparency. And the Freedom of Information Act was never intended to be a limitation on public information. It was meant to facilitate. But now a lot of public officials, as Kaylin is saying, will fall back on that and say, I won't release it unless you file a Freedom of Information Law request.
Now, some of these public officials have bad reputations. Some are worse than others. It's my impression that Governor Cuomo, for example, has not been in the forefront of those people who are saying release everything fast.
Nor was Barack Obama. I mean, the Cuomo side of things has, I mean, it started from when he was Attorney General and when he made the transition, when a lot of these documents that were in his archives as Attorney General somehow didn't make the trip to the state archives from the file drawers of the Attorney General's office. They were disposed of. And now, as governor, he's implemented policies that enable the destruction of a lot of electronic records very quickly, so that the trail of what has gone on inside government will never be found.
So this is so interesting to me because, you know, there are times I really think some of his actions are despicable. But what I can't figure out is how people get to know about it. We have this little show here, the Media Project. We may say what we just said, but, you know, you go down to New York City, they don't even know there is a Capitol in Albany. Maybe that's a little, and they certainly don't know that Governor Cuomo has been accused of being, you know, tough when it comes to freedom of information so that they can have information in the press, nor do they care.
Yes. It's hard to get that point across, and people don't. Plus, as a journalist, you sometimes feel like you don't want to be just whining about how hard your job is. The idea is to get the information and convey it to the public, and your job is not to have to tell people, oh my goodness, they made me do this, and so part of it is the humility. You have to get out of the way of the story and not say, look at me, how hard I worked to get this story. On the other hand, it does drive you a little bit crazy sometimes that it is so hard just to get the information that ought to be public, right?
Right.
I don't think reporters are looking for either that sort, generally looking for any attention to be paid about how hard they worked. I think the satisfaction in that job is getting the information and telling readers, listeners, and viewers how important this story is and that it has an effect on their lives.
Now, in Albany, we have a legendary figure who all three of us know fairly well, Bob Freeman, who is the head of the Freedom of Information group. And people come to him all the time and say, should I be allowed to have this? And he says, yes, you should.
He's a state employee. The State Committee on Open Government is part of the Secretary of State's office. And for 40 years, he's been running this outfit. And
coming to our classes to talk to us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Indeed.
I remember when I was a student at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, here was this young lawyer who they brought in.
Well, you graduated first in your class,
And that young lawyer travels all around the globe helping other countries learn about New York State's freedom of information law because we supposedly have one of the best laws. It needs work, you know.
Part of it is thanks to Bob for being that advocate for standing up and insisting that the law be interpreted.
But my point was
that
even though he says it, you're entitled to it, it doesn't always happen.
Yes, that's right. He does not have authority to actually make the government release anything. Yeah, he's just advisory.
But he has generated thousands, literally a single man has generated thousands of opinions, all of which are accessible on this Committee on Open Government's website and can be used when you're building a case to support your argument over FOI for a particular case you want to go forward with. This is not limited to the journalism corps, the press corps. Any member of the public is able to use the Freedom of Information Law, and I would encourage everyone to do that if there's information they're looking for. The website All Over Albany has an excellent story this week generated from Freedom of Information Law that talks about sidewalk shoveling in Albany and has used an interactive map in which they identify all of the places in the city where individuals did not shovel their snow and the city cited them. It is wonderful. It's a great example of using FOI to help serve the public.
That's very cool. Yeah. Good for them. Yeah. And that's a little two-person operation.
Indeed.
So that shows that you don't have to have a vast newsroom staff to generate great reporting. How about that? That's very
cool. What? How about what?
You don't need a big staff to generate great
sidewalk,
reporting.
You said, how about that?
Oh, how about that?
Which is one of your nervous tics.
Glad to have your support, Alan. It's the Media Project for Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok, Kaylin Brown, and Rex Smith. If you want to share your thoughts with us so that we can take a look at it and convey your points of view, media@wamc.org, media@wamc.org. You know, I'm going to actually have a hat made, you know, one of those red hats like they had in the Trump campaign that said, Make America Great Again.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to have one that says, Trump, M-I-R-A, as in making investigative reporting cool again, right? Something like that.
Yes, Northeastern University just had a big convention, sort of a conference for journalists, in which they spoke about the how investigative journalism is quote unquote cool again.
Mm-hmm.
And there were many Pulitzer Prize winners there, members of the Spotlight team from the Boston Globe, talking about the value of digging deep, cultivating reporters, trying to use evidence to support journalism, and that newsrooms need investigative teams, even though they absorb a lot of resources. They are pivotal to good journalism.
You know, it's one of the interesting elements that they discuss, that there is a, that we've seen a rise of advocacy journalism as opposed to investigative journalism, and the importance of kind of not crossing that line, that the notion of putting a story out there and seeing what happens. But investigative journalism is evidence-based. Eric Umansky, who is Deputy Managing Editor of ProPublica, said this, investigative reporting is evidence-based, humble in its conclusions, careful, judicious, fair, and true. So that is different from putting out there a point of view that argues something in particular, which is sort of the trend in a lot of reporting these days.
I would argue with you, Rex, as I have many times, and Kaylin, that in fact, much of what we read in the newspapers is advocacy journalism, even though it's well disguised, that it has a point of view and the selection of the topic is clearly, you know, get 'em. So when I read the New York Times, I always get the idea that, you know, Trump is not their favorite person. And if a Trump story comes up that they can make something out of, they do, which is okay with me because I think the same way. But I think it would be naive of you, Rex. And that's one thing I sometimes worry about with you. Naivete is that you know you think that that advocacy stops at a certain point. I think it's there all the time.
I don't necessarily think that this word we're batting around, advocacy, is negative. So when the press reports about a murder, are they advocating that people don't murder, or are they just reporting these are the facts behind this murder? When they report about sexual harassment, are they advocating that sexual harassment is a big thing and that we should be paying attention to it, or are they advocating for the good reporting that has that particular viewpoint? I mean, the story just recently about Charlie Rose was well reported, multi-sourced, and someone would walk away, a reader and a member of the audience, believing that, well, they're advocating that sexual harassment is bad. Why is that negative?
No, first of all, if you're trying to put words in my mouth, you failed miserably. I don't believe that at all. I agree with you. I think that journalism is journalism. I think when the editor sits down and says, okay, this time we have a story between this and this, and we're going to choose this, the editor is basically editorializing. I know you guys don't believe that, but the selection of the topic can often be advocacy on the part of the newspaper that is doing that. Now, you know, frankly, Kaylin, I think you're the best, but I think that that was a cheap trick trying to put words in my mouth that I felt something that I had said something like what you said.
Well, so there's a lot of criticism about the current state of affairs in Washington. And I think most of the press in this country would suggest that there is a current assault on the Constitution. So is it wrong for the press to advocate in favor of the Constitution? Because every time it writes something negative about our current president, it is pointing out the inadequacies of what's happening in government.
Well,
what about
science? I think you and Rex have a big problem here because you don't agree with each other.
What about this? Yeah. What about? No, I don't think so.
Well,
what about the assault on science? What about the assault on science?
What about him?
Well, is it advocacy journalism when the media point out that the Environmental Protection Agency is turning away from science, from what scientists have said in its handling of climate change?
I couldn't agree with you more. Let's pretend that we're all sitting there in the morning meeting at the Washington Post or even mm-hmm. Times Union or whatever. And, you know, there is an unknown story about how the government is playing their environmental stuff that nobody knows about. Along comes Rex, his associate Mike Spain, the people on the editorial board, and they say, well, you know, let's take this out of the shadows and let's make something out of this. That's an advocacy decision.
No, that is a good reporting decision. I think you have to be careful about use of the term. Maybe that's all it is. Maybe we're just, since I'm the only one here without a PhD, I don't have the problem of having to parse the words as carefully. But it's a... doing my best. It's advocacy only in the sense that you are making a decision about what you cover. It's not that we are... And I think advocating in support of the best path toward truth, which science provides, not partisanship. That's not advocacy. That's truth-telling. That's accuracy.
Well, you're not going to get me to argue that with you. I think it's splendid that it's done. However, as I have often quoted him on this show, Judge Jerome Frank said years and years ago that we ought to psychoanalyze every judge to know what is involved in their making decisions. For example, decisions on race, color, that kind of thing. Now, I have a feeling that editors who are sitting around a table have a mindset based on their political views and that they're going to follow them. I'm not saying they shouldn't. I'm just saying they do.
Well, the place where you see it most often, I have sitting in front of me here, the two tabloids from New York City, the Daily News and the New York Post. By the way, talk about disparity of views. The front page of the Daily News says tomorrow's high 53, or today's high 53, and the New York Post says today's high 56. Who's right? Anyway.
Correction.
Both of them have essentially the same headline. It is, in the New York Post, it is, with the subhead, Trump backs Roy Moore, it says, I'm with the pervert. And the Daily News, a little bit more catchingly, says, I'm with perv. Trump endorses accused kid molester Moore. So now, Alan, there is something to be said for your point of view in this case, that because these are publications that are blatantly advocates.
They are, and they're juxtaposed to each other up to now, although the New York Post has been moving over to the more moderate side from their earlier advocacy of things right.
But editors at both those newspapers, I'm sorry, Alan, editors at both those newspapers made a decision independently that that was the most worthy statement to put on their covers. So is that advocacy on behalf of 16-year-old girls who shouldn't be pursued by perverts? Or is it a decision to pay attention to what's happening in the news and come up reductively as little as possible in a huge headline? This is what is happening here and now. Our president is supporing a pervert.
You know, I always
that.
Yeah, well, it's very nice. however, it's also a little naive, to be honest with you, because I think these guys want to sell newspapers. They try to figure out what's what. Now, I think that the New York Post, which was always a right-wing organ, has moved over substantially, and it may well have to do more with Rupert Murdoch, and this has been in print in every other place, is wanting to get the franchise in Europe for DirecTV, whatever it's called over there, than it is about doing the right thing, which you two guys always argue is what journalism is all about, but it isn't. It's all about business. It's all about money. It's all about selling papers.
And on that point, we will have to end the show because we're out of time. You know, we'll let Alan have the last word about how awful journalists are anyway. Thank you for joining us this week on The Media Project.
It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.